Stein Online's live Clubland Q&A is just 1 minute away.
This is Mark Stein, back after four sellout voyages for the fifth annual Mark Stein Cruise. If you like the sound of April in Portugal and Spain on the fabulous new ship, the Celebrity Apex, well, you'll be at the apex of celebrity for our traditional week of sun, sea, and civilizational collapse. I'll have special guests from both sides of the Atlantic, including a reunion of all your favourite telly presenters from the glory days of GB News, who've since been sacked. And we'll do all the things you like about the Mark Stein Show and Stein Online, but close up and on water. More details at steinonline.com or marksteincruise.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. March 12th, 2025, which means, if you know your time differences, that we're in that wacky month when one side of the Atlantic has sprung into summer while the other side remains fallen back in winter. So, it is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, but, beyond the Americas, 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time in London, 8 p.m. in Paris, 9 p.m. in Kiev. Yeah, that's not bad. 10 p.m. in Moscow, 10:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, sorry about that. 6 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, still sort of sorry. 8 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more convivial hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Happy National Day to our Mauritian listeners, commemorating the date in 1968 when the Crown Colony of Mauritius became independent, save for a certain archipelago that had been carved out 3 years earlier to become a brand new crown colony, the British Indian Ocean Territory, which has one of the coolest British ensigns in the whole Commonwealth, for fans of our old Know Your Ensigns competition. New crown colony, then new, is on the chopping block. The bastard Starmer is determined to offload it. Congratulations to our friends at Gripped Media in Ireland. You'll have seen various Gripped writers on our show over the years. John McGurk, Laura Perrins, Ben Scallon. But the ever more totalitarian Dublin government dislikes Gripped's coverage of the so-called migrants. And they were trying to backdoor their way into Gripped's data via Twitter until Elon Musk told the government to take a hike and, for good measure, broke some Dublin injunction not to let Gripped know what the devious bastards are trying to do. Okay, lots to talk about today, so let us get to your question. Oh, David Kelly Wood writes, as plays on words go, hockey sticking it to the man is admittedly pretty strained. But what the heck, it's all I've got. Unfortunately, the process as the punishment isn't reversible. Still, it's good to feel good not being the one getting dumped on for a change. Anyway, congratulations on that much, and fingers crossed that the winning streak keeps on keeping on. Take care. James Holman adds, off topic, but huge congratulations, Mark. From What's Up With That, that's Anthony Watts' climate website, breaking. Judge sanctions Michael E. Mann for bad faith trial misconduct in Mann versus Free Speech. Bad faith indeed. An apt moniker for Mann and the lawyer he rode in on, says James Holman. This is breaking news. Happened about an hour ago. So just before showtime. As you'll recall, this time last week, we had some breaking news that the $1 million the jury decided that I had to pay Michael E. Mann in punitive damages was reduced by the D.C. Superior Court to $5,000. So Michael E. Mann lost $995,000 this time last week. We now have another, I suppose I ought to say, I rise on a point of personal privilege, as the parliamentarians do, because I should be talking about Ukraine or Mark Carney or whatever, but I will just get this this get out of the way. There, as What's Up With That said, the Judge Irving in the sixth trial judge in the District of Columbia Superior Court has sanctioned Michael E. Mann for bad faith trial misconduct. And Justin Miller, my lawyer, who stayed up all night. These motions were filed over a year ago, but why hurry? What's the expression? Justice delayed is justice denied. I don't think they have that expression in the District of Columbia. But he stayed up all night way back when, whatever it was, January or February 2024, and wrote the motion. You can see pictures of me with my lawyers at the time of the trial. I think didn't we use them for Senite of Stein this week? I think there's me with Justin and Chris. But anyway, just before I came on, Justin excerpted, because it's like one of these long rulings from the court. And back when I got my first one, I thought they were quite interesting and I used to read them, but I looked at the length of this one and couldn't be bothered. So Justin very kindly excerpted some of the choicer bits. And because Michael E. Mann has yet to comment on losing $995,000 last week, I don't suppose he's in a hurry to comment on this either. But it's pretty good. The court must conclude that Mr. Williams and Mr. Fontaine, their man's lawyers, two principal lawyers, the court must conclude that Mr. Williams and Mr. Fontaine not only knew about the falsity of the information contained in Exhibits 517A and Exhibit 117 and made false representations to the court and jury, but they also failed to discharge their duty as officers of the court to correct the falsehoods that they should not have presented in the first place. Both attorneys deliberately engaged in outright misrepresentation. Do they have a bar counsel in the District of Columbia, or are they way beyond that now? Both attorneys deliberately engaged in outright misrepresentations. Setting aside questions of credibility or even perjury, that's Michael E. Mann he's talking about there, your friendly neighborhood perjurer. Michael E. Mann, the perjurer. Setting aside questions of credibility or even perjury, Mr. Williams and Mr. Fontaine knowingly violated the rules of professional conduct. Dr. Mann's assertion that there was no falsehood or misrepresentation in his testimony or his counsel's conduct borders on frivolity. The record plainly shows the deliberate and knowing misconduct of Dr. Mann's counsel in eliciting false testimony from Dr. Mann. Nor did any purported unfairness caused by defendants' legally correct objections somehow relieve Dr. Mann's counsel of their duties as officers of the court and members of a I'll try and read this with a straight face. Nor did any purported unfairness somehow relieve Dr. Mann's counsel of their duties as officers of the court and members of a profession dedicated to honesty and integrity. Dr. Mann's counsel's bad faith misconduct is an affront to the court's authority and an attack on the integrity of the proceedings warranting sanctions. As I said, Justin stayed up all night during the trial to write his motion there. And you can see a picture of me with Chris and Justin taken during the trial. I think it's up at Senate of Stein at the moment. Steve from Manhattan says, Mark, on October the 22nd, 2012, a date that we in the Montenegrin brigand community think should live in infamy. Yeah, Steve, when he was on our Adriatic cruise, I think it was last year, we put in at Montenegro, which is a fantastic place, and he did a very good impression of our in-house Montenegrin brigand, of which we could use a few more, I think. But anyway, Steve says, October 22nd, 2012, a date that should live in infamy. Dr. Professor Michael E. Mann, PhD, filed his defamation of a Nobel Prize winner lawsuit against you and other defendants. That was 4,524 days ago. If I round up to the nearest penny and I disregard, as I'm sure Dr. Professor Mann will do, the million or so that Dr. Mann will owe to other parties in the case for legal fees, that yields Dr. Mann $1.33 per day for his efforts. My question, do you think there has ever been a day in the last 12 years and 3 months when Dr. Mann produced or created something worth $1.33? No, not at all. But you know what? After that jury awarded $1 million from me to Mann, Mann unblocked me on his Twitter feed. He had blocked me in 2012 when the case started, and so I wasn't in his timeline. I couldn't comment on anything he said. All the rest of it. And then after the stupid, corrupt, lazy, know-nothing jury awarded him $1 million from me, he unblocked me just so he could sort of generally piss on me on Twitter, mocking me and taunting me with what I owed, which he did a few times. And so anyway, after he lost, his $1 million was reduced by the court to $5,000. I tried to see what he was saying about it, and he's blocked me all over again. But here's the point when you're talking about $1.33, because who wouldn't? That's like one of those things. How would you like to, you know, that guy down the street that you really don't like? How would you like to tie him up in a decade and a half of legal bollocks at the bargain price of just $1.33 a day? That's whatever it is, a fifth of what your stupid decaf macchiato costs. When you put it like that, it sounds very reasonable. But here's the reality now. Last week, when I became, at least on paper, $995,000 richer than I'd been the week before, I still owed Michael E. Mann $5,000, which in anything other than litigation would be quite a large sum of money. So Michael E. Mann could still have gone swanking around town saying, yeah, I showed that Stein guy. I took him for $5,000. I took him for $5,000. Where's your check, Stein? And there were people in our comments section saying, oh, why don't you pay him in pennies? And then somebody said, better yet, pay him in Canadian pennies. And all this kind of thing. Well, I don't have to pay him anything now because of these sanctions. So the net result of the last week and a half is that the final score, if there's such a thing as a final score, but I think this actually, I think the chance, the possibility of any big payday for Mann is completely off the table now. But right now, I don't have to pay him $5,000 because what the sanctions that the judge has ordered will come to more than that. And so Michael E. Mann is now going to have to write a check to my co-defendant, Rand Simberg. He's going to have to write a check to National Review. He's going to have to write a check to the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And he's going to have to write a check to me. And none of us are going to have to write a check to him. Right? So that's the final score. Get out your checkbook, deadbeat man. That's now all the jokes about paying him in Canadian pennies, all that's off. He is to pay me. He is to get out the checkbook. So we'll have a bit more. I think we've posted the judge's order, but I think we might have a bit more to say about this at Stein Online tomorrow. Lenny Cooperman says, Michael E. Mann, by the way, that was, people joke about climate change, but I saw from that awful, terrible, lousy jury pool in the District of Columbia that there are people who take all this rubbish seriously. The new Prime Minister of Canada takes it seriously. He was the central banker's climate. If you take all the central bankers from the G7, he was the central banker's climate nut, Mark Carney, former governor of the Bank of England. But Lenny Cooperman says, hi, Mark. No scientific graph, supposedly, made as much difference to the cause of the climate panic than Michael E. Mann's hockey stick. So I hope that's a consolation to him as he's having to get out his checkbook and write four checks. By the way, the total of those four checks will be a seven-figure sum. Now, he's been bankrolled these last 13 years by some unknown sugar daddy. Now, what's clear is that Mann is a loser. There's no big bucks. So do you still want to carry on? If you're listening, Mr. Sugar Daddy, George Soros or USAID or whoever it is that's bankrolling this bollocks, he's a loser. Do you want to carry on bankrolling the loser for another? I think our lawyer's estimate was if he's determined to drag out everything, every appeal that can be appealed, we'd have another 10 years of it. But the outcome won't be the same because Mann's a loser and you, George Soros, or you, USAID, which I guess means you, US taxpayers, which includes me, we're paying for a loser who just keeps losing. Anyway, Lady Cooperman says, hi, Mark. Congratulations on the good news from the DC Superior Court. My question pertains to the back and forth currently taking place between the USA and Canada. What are your views on the appropriateness and likelihood of our two countries becoming one? And who do you think should absorb whom? Well, I don't think the Dominion of Canada is in a position to absorb the United States. Although, maybe if we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of province and state swaps. There are some states that Vermont would be a pretty good fit in Canada as the 11th province. But realistically here, this is like a sort of vaudevillian version of Russia and Ukraine. Canada is in America's sphere of influence. The Greenland just had an election. When was it? I think, well, the results were declared yesterday. I think the right of the center right party supposedly won, but the actual acquisition of Greenland by the United States was basically the biggest topic in that election, because it's the first time Greenland's made international news. Now, people think, at first people thought this was just Trump just messing around, but it's not. The world is changing. Basically, the map was frozen during the Cold War. As soon as the Second World War was ended, the Cold War began, and then the decolonization era. I was just talking about Mauritius independence in 1968. After the Second World War, you know, one continent, Europe, had entirely owned another continent, Africa. And after the Second World War, the Cold War settled in, and then decolonization. But the map was essentially frozen. And so if the Soviets thought they could pick off some rinky-dink little ramshackle basket case on the edge of the map, it became a big international thing. In other words, it was the sort of long tail of the 20th century, and indeed the 19th century, the 19th century scramble for Africa. And then the big war of the big wars of the 20th century. And Trump understands that era is very belatedly coming to an end, and something new is emerging. And you don't hear that when you go to these stupid get-togethers they have for the G7 or for NATO. Everybody is basically talking as if it's 1950 forever, and it isn't, and Trump gets that. And as I said last week, I don't want to get too emotional over it, because I actually feel rather sad about it. I loved the old Dominion of Canada. I didn't like the new Trudeauian Canada, where he basically dismantled the old Dominion of Canada and replaced it with himself. I always compare it to Liberace, who made his lover have plastic surgery to look like Liberace, so that Liberace could experience the sensation of making love to himself. That's basically what Pierre Trudeau did with Canada in the 1970s and early 80s. And I mourn the death of the ancient and honourable nation that existed before that, but it's not coming back. And so the question then is, you know, do you want to be some semi-Islamized Chinese-owned squat, or would you rather take a flyer on Trump's offer to make you the 51st state? I certainly think that's a question. I mean, I think that's a question worth asking for Canadians and for Americans. I don't detect a lot of enthusiasm for absorbing Canada. But I like the idea. I like the way Trump just puts all these things in play, because in Greenland, it's seriously in play. Seriously in play. And I think that's good. I think it's... I don't think it's not 1950 anymore. And so operating on 1950 assumption, I loathe. By the way, that sesquicentennial thing, the 150th birthday of Canada, that's when I thought, my God, you know, Pierre Trudeau, as I said, he did the Liberace thing and remade Canada in his own image. Right. Justin was worse. Because Justin killed his dad's version of Canada. I never liked his dad's version of Canada, all the multiculturalism crap. Because we talk about that now. Canada was the first country on the planet to have a minister for multiculturalism in the Canadian cabinet. It was all bollocks back in 1970, and it's bollocks today. But Justin managed to kill... His dad killed the old Dominion of Canada... Justin killed his dad's multi-culti Trudopia, and that left just this hideous void that now will have Mark Carney running the place. Richard Borsichowski, I hope I pronounced that correctly, says, "Greetings and salutations from the not yet 51st state of America. As expected, the WEF, UN, and three passport-carrying elitist Mark Carney won..." I'm surprised he's only got that few really. "...won the Liberal Party's nomination. What is absolutely unbelievable is that all 338 federal ridings had the same margin of victory, no matter the geography, population, or demography. Even in the other candidates' home ridings. For a man no one had heard of a month ago. Is it time to find that last photocopier and hide it in the woods?" Yeah, I saw Ezra Levant's thing about this, and he's right. Just as Biden's numbers did not look right, you know, he lost all the swing districts except one, I think, but somehow still managed to, because those are tough to steal, actually, the ones where they're just on a cigarette paper between the two things. Because another 100 votes can tip it one way. So they preferred to seal them in blue cities in purple states where they controlled the whole racket. And so Joe Biden's numbers never looked real. And Mark Carney's numbers don't look real compared to a normal competitive Canadian leadership election. I mean, I don't understand why anyone would want to make Chrystia Freeland Prime Minister, but I do get that a lot of, if you're a Liberal Party voter, she seems very plausible to you. And this was not, and especially as he did not, I mean, that French debate he supposedly took place in, he took part in, was just a fiasco. And so now we have this thing where basically there's this one size fits all result that has been imposed on the entire nation, which Canada never has for any kind of election. I mean, one of the reasons why it's so difficult to predict a general election in Canada is because the Maritimes and Quebec and the Toronto suburbs and the West all vote in bewildering ways and in different and distinct ways. There's not really, in that sense, a national pattern. I mean, a Quebec pattern can destabilize the whole thing, even if it's utterly irrelevant to anything going on in Manitoba. And yet here, apparently, wherever you are, whatever language you speak, it's entirely uniform, this election. And as Richard points out, no one had heard of this guy a month ago. He was a big name. The only reason he became a big name in Britain was because he was the head honcho of Project Fear, which was the anti-Brexit campaign. So he ties in with Nigel Farage and all that because... he was the one who all this stuff that, if you vote for Brexit, there's going to be new killer strains of gonorrhea. decimating the land, right? From Bognor Regis to Belfast. This new lethal strain of killer gonorrhea is going to get you if you vote for Brexit. And all this rubbish, Mark Carney was behind as governor of the Bank of England. Now, before being governor of the Bank of England, he'd been governor of the Bank of Canada. That's how indispensable the guy is. My daughter But no one knows. The difference is no one in Canada knows who the governor of the Bank of Canada is. The governor of the Bank of England is a bit different because his views are sought out and he goes on television and things. The governor of the Bank of Canada is entirely peripheral. For my daughter did a sort of summer job at the Bank of Canada in Ottawa a couple of years ago, and I said, who's in charge now? Mark Carney's skipped to London. She works for the guy. She didn't know his name. And so I used to, when I'd go to Ottawa and see her, I'd introduce her to people. When they said, "Oh, what does she do at the Bank of Canada?" I'd say, "Oh, she sets the interest rates." Basically, because once Mark Carney had skipped to London, nobody knew. So you're right to say that he's no one had ever heard of him. Now, here's the thing. As I just put this in, I think our piece that's up on at Stein Online, the lead piece on the homepage, this hilarious clip where Chrystia Freeland, who lost spectacularly badly to Mark Carney, reveals that Mark Carney is the godfather of her son. He is the godfather. He's going to make you an offer you can't refuse. It's nothing personal. It's strictly business. But Mark Carney is literally the godfather. And I don't believe, you know, when the last Canadian Tory leadership thing I took an interest in was when a close interest in the results of the one a few years ago in which what was the big issue? Oh, yeah, the milk subsidies, or ending the milk subsidies, proved the decisive issue in determining the election. So you looked at these Quebec rural ridings. So, yeah, there are supposed to be rural fluctuations in these things. There are fluctuations within the province, you know, like between Montreal and rural districts or whatever, and then in Ontario between the southern Ontario, Toronto suburbs and the rest of the province. But this is apparent uniformity. And it is just the consolidation, you know. Oh, someone in Klaus Schwab in his hollowed out Alp at the Spectre board meeting in Davos has decided he penetrated the cabinets, and so Justin Trudeau has outlived his usefulness, and we've decided that Mark Carney, can you book some cheapo one-way flight from Heathrow back to Montreal, change for Ottawa, because it looks like we're going to need you to become the Canadian Prime Minister. Oh, I don't know. I've never heard of this guy. Why should he be my Prime Minister? Okay, if you don't like Mark Carney, the other choice is Mark Carney's godson's mum, Chrystia Freeland. As I said earlier today, it's like dynastic marriages in medieval Europe. It's completely preposterous. These are, you know, it's ruled by experts. These are the world's worst. They're supposed to be technocrats. Oh, we're way beyond all that, you know, the Workers' Party and the Toffs Party and all that kind of stuff. We're just a great expert class. They're the world's. This is ridiculous. Doug Cole says, "Hi, Mark. In all the fuss about Mr. Carney becoming Canada's next Justin Castro, where do you suppose this leaves the opposition leader Poiliev? It seems he was gaining ground in Canada with his common sense approach, at least until Canadians decided they like being leftist putzes in opposition to Trump. What is your take on all this?" You have to be, well, you know the way if you saw that show where after he slapped down those MPs who'd met with Christine Anderson, I'm so sick of this. I'm so sick of the right-wing guy being Mr. Gatekeeper. You know, like Farage going around boasting that his greatest accomplishment is that he killed off the far right, you know. And so Poiliev said, Christine Anderson was a member of the European, an elected member of the European Parliament. Why can't his backbenchers meet with her? He didn't have to do that. He just got, I started calling him Pierre Poiliev in that thing. I really didn't like it at all. I'm just bored by that, because we have to move the meter. And we've had all the incrementalism of so-called right of centre parties being elected. And then, you know, just, oh, I don't know that it's safe for me to do anything conservative. You know, at some point, you know, these countries are going to be gone by the time of the... When we plan, were you thinking, oh, maybe it'll be safe to be a little bit conservative 2, 3, 4 election cycles down the line? There isn't going to be a Canada by then. There isn't going to be a United Kingdom by then. There isn't going to be a French Republic by then. You know, we are in the end stages. I'm being serious about this. That's why I put a link today to... Louise Perry's interview with that guy, Canadian, by the way, Professor Betts from King's College London, talking about the gaming out the likelihood of civil war, because we are coming to the end, not just the end of the Second World War victory parade preserved in Aspic, but the end of But the actual end of some of the world's oldest sovereign states as they have existed for the entirety of their history. And the reason people don't want to even think about that is because for certain kinds of people, for certain sort of, you know, upper middle class people, life is pretty comfortable. Why would you want to think, oh, my God, the whole powder keg's about to go up? So in Canada, Pierre Poilievre is very good in the media. You know, when he had his big apple munching moment with an idiot journalist. But that's not a fair fight. You know, if he's just good when he's munching an apple with an idiot journalist, is he going to be good when he's facing Mark Carney across the House of Commons? Now, I don't expect Mark Carney to be good, because this is Mark Carney's first job in politics. He was offered the post of finance minister by Stephen Harper and declined it because he didn't think it was proper for a civil servant to go from being governor of a central bank straight into politics. But I don't like the incrementalism, because we don't have time for the incrementalism now. We don't have time for the incrementalism. And the great thing about Trump, whatever you say, the first statement he made as a political candidate was that Mexico is sending us rapists and murderers and not sending its best. And everybody thought, oh, God, this guy's nuts. He's not going to get anywhere. And in fact, that was the reality, as recognized by a lot of people. A lot of people nobody even cares about or thinks about in Washington. Now, the interesting thing in Canada, when Doug says because they prefer being leftist putzes standing up to Trump, maybe that'll get you so far. But times are tough in Canada. I mean, Justin Trudeau really did a number on the entire economy. You have to be able to afford to be a putz. You know, we come back to that thing that a reader sent me a decade and a half ago. We're rich enough that we can afford to be stupid. That isn't true for a lot of people in America. It isn't true for proportionately a lot more people in Canada. It isn't true for a lot of people in Britain. It isn't true for a lot of people in France. You have to be able to afford to be a putz. And I'm not so sure That may be the best thing Poiliev has going for him. That and Carney has no idea, by the way. Carney's wrong about everything. You know, as I said, he's the net zero nut of the G7 of the G7 central bankers. I don't think that he has. I don't think he has much of a clue on how well people are doing. But he is literally the godfather. So if you're minded to question him, you could end up with a horse's head in your bed. This is Stein Online's Clubland Q&A, live around Stein Online's Clubland Q&A, live around the planet. It is 21 minutes to the hour, and this is the favourite part of the show for so many people, because Mark Stein, he's such a glamorous figure, particularly now he's got all this money from Michael E. Mann, but he does swing by for 30 seconds or so just to let you know what's coming up on our weekend music show. Take it away, Mark. This is Mark Stein. On the town this week, songs across the century, songs around the world, a cavalcade of non-stop number ones. Plus, Irving Caesar, the great lyricist of Swanee and Just a Gigolo, takes me through one of his biggest hits. And Frank Sinatra gets his Irish up. On the town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio. Yeah, and don't forget that Saturday at 5 is London time. That means it's 6 p.m. in Western Europe, and for this month only, 1 p.m. North American Eastern time. Mark Stein, live around the planet. It is 20 to 4 Eastern. That's 20 to 8 Greenwich Mean Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're well and looking forward to the upcoming Mark Stein cruise. Yeah, that's next month. Is it fair to say without equivocation that Nigel Farage has picked on the wrong puppy with Rupert Lowe? I believe in Lowe, the biter is bit. I've never believed that Nigel is really a man of the right, as he appears to be by instinct a social libertarian. And as we all know, it would be impossible to have mass deportations, even if it was in the national interest. You have often described him as a gatekeeper, which is fair, but is he remotely conservative? Well, this is, as you know, I'm astonished, actually, that there are people still willing to defend Farage, including people I respect. The problem is that what he's done, you know, you don't complain to the police unless you think even to the useless Brit wanker coppers. You go to the police if you think there's a crime, because you're reporting the criminal. Like when someone, like if you own a convenience store and someone busts in and steals your stuff, you say, oh yeah, I got a good look at him. He's about 5'9" with dark hair, and, you know. That's what they did. That's what Farage did to Rupert Lowe. You do that because you want the guy behind bars, right? Because he's committed a crime and you want him jailed for it. And I love the way even the wanker UK media isn't pretending that these allegations are anything worth talking about. They're just talking about it in terms of, you know, what Farage said about Lowe and what Lowe said about. No one's thinking, oh, is the implication that he's some sort of, which they did deliberately, that he's some sort of Harvey Weinstein sicko, right? Can't keep his hands off the help. You know, no one's taking that seriously. No one on it, whatever side of this you're on. So the question then is, you've got a guy who tried to Harvey Weinstein one of his MPs. That's pretty weird. That's pretty bad. Now, you say, I try to look at it as other people will look at it, because the first time I met Nigel, we were doing a panel together, and I didn't really know anything about him other than the little clip that made his name, where he accused Herman Van Rompuy of having the charisma of a low-grade Belgian bank clerk. And the European Parliament insisted he apologise for that, but for talking about the President of Europe like that. And so Nigel Farage then issued an apology to Belgian bank clerks for comparing them to the so-called President of Europe. And I thought that was pretty funny. And then the first thing that I did with him, we won a panel thing together, and people who only knew him from his rumpy pumpy thing were engaged by him and found him funny. So I had a kind of professional respect for him. But I never... the one thing he had, I don't think you're right about the social libertarian thing, because he said things to me that are, for example, rather homophobic, I would say, rather, but I don't know whether he's, just to sort of back up a bit, I don't know whether he's genuinely homophobic or whether he's just pretending to be homophobic as part of his sort of pub bore persona. What he is, I think, what he's been able to do is he was culturally a certain type of Englishman at a time when no other politicians wanted to be. And that worked very well with Brexit. Because the fact that he likes, 60 fags a day, that's in the British sense, by the way, not evidence of his phony homophobia or anything, but he likes 60 fags a day and 30 pints a day. And he's the kind of guy that you used to, at a certain type, you'd go into the pub and you go in the door and there's the saloon bar on the left and the lounge bar on the right, or the snug, as they say about the English pubs. And he's the kind of guy who would be sitting there in tweeds or whatever by the fire in the lounge bar or the snug. And he was very... So I think it was like a cultural conservatism, Chris. I don't think he's not interested in ideas. He's not interested in intellectuals. So, for example, he found... he's got no interest in being on stage with Jordan Peterson. I don't suppose he has any interest in being on stage with me, although we have been several times. But he's not interested in ideas. He never has been. But he had this one thing which was perfect for the European question, because he's more English than David Cameron. He's more English than Keir Starmer. He's more English than whatever nitwit is running the Liberal Democrat Party. And that was the perfect vehicle. So when he used to call Herman Van Rompuy, the so-called European president, he used to call him Rumpy Pumpy, because that's one of, 50,000 British synonyms for sex. But it's a slightly obsolete synonym, British synonym for sex. So when he's talking about Rumpy Pumpy, and I saw this with an audience in Toronto, they all fell around laughing because it fits. We want to get out of the European Union so we can have a smoke at the pub and talk about Rumpy Pumpy. It was a kind of cultural conservatism. But now we know. And the thing that did it for me, by the way, is he says because of what Rupert Lowe. Rupert Lowe took up. I knew this from... I probably shouldn't be doing half this stuff. But when I joined GB News, I was astonished by how shriveled and withered the Farage show was, because it was in the... There were still lockdowns for the COVID. So there was an obvious... a bit of freedom there to open up a bit of space on that topic. But he wasn't, you know, he was the guy, don't forget, who called on Tony Blair to be made the COVID czar and the vaccine czar and all this. He wasn't interested in going down that path. He didn't touch, he didn't talk about things like Islam or the grooming gangs. It was a boring show. I said, having not seen the show the first time I was on GB News, I was asked whether I was interested in politics. I said I have no interest in who's going to be next week's Lord Privy Seal. And then you switch on Farage's show, and it's all, and he keeps talking about we're interested in the concerns of real people beyond the M25, and we're not in the Westminster Village. And in fact, the show is a classic Westminster Village show. So, but what he had going for him was this cultural conservatism. Now, when he said, I've written about this since he got his Islamo money bags. Zia Yusuf, the party chairman he brought in, he doesn't want to go anywhere near Islam. He's accepted the fact that the United Kingdom is transitioning to a semi-Islamic society, which, as we all know, is an interim stage. You can go to Alexandria or Syria or all kinds of other places, and you will know that a semi-Islamic society is an interim stage before a wholly Islamic society. He doesn't want to go anywhere near that kind of talk. And the one that did it for me, though, was this thing he did, was it today or yesterday, where he said that it was unforgivable what Rupert Lowe had said about the grooming gangs things. He said, I've been speaking out about the grooming gangs for 10 years. Sammy Woodhouse, for example, appears to be entirely unfamiliar with that. And she likes the way that from her own experience, she has tried to interest Farage and whichever party he was then running in the topic. But that's the bottom line thing for me, because what kind of crap-ass wanker is prepared to sacrifice the girls of England just because they're not the kind of girls he'd be interested in, although he has quite Catholic tastes in that respect. He doesn't want to do an inquiry or all the rest of it, because it's like de classe. They're the wrong sort of girls. They're just these white slags and packy shaggers in Rotherham and Rochdale and Oldham and Telford and Banbury and Oxford. I don't think because you're a snob, you have a right to write off the maidenhood of England. I find that completely disgusting. The indifference to these girls completely disgusts me. Because actually, you know, you've seen them on the show. Sammy Woodhouse and Samantha Smith in particular, they're different, I know, because they're effective on TV and radio and whatnot. In a way that a lot of these girls aren't. The poor girl who supposedly was fed into a kebab mincer. You know, she was just an ordinary girl. She wasn't going to be a big celebrity or anything. She would just have, you know, worked in a shop or something. But she didn't deserve to be fed into a kebab mincer. This is evil. But because, you know... he doesn't want to. It's a bit hot for Nigel. His whole thing is the culturally conservative thing. The fact that he isn't He doesn't think about these things, and he's about. But that thing that he said today just did it for me. This guy's got to go. He's not gonna do it for you. These people who are rather clever and prominent people who say, "Oh well, we have to stick with Nigel because he got us this far." He got out of Brexit has been bungled. Brexit has been bungled, completely bollocksed. It's in fact inflicted huge damage on the union. The greatest damage to the union since the creation of the Irish Free State in 1922. He pretended to be Mr. Unionist. He sold himself to the traditional Ulster voice, who was supposed to bump up his parliamentary numbers a bit. He sold himself as that to two very nice ladies, Kate Hoey and Arlene Foster. They're both baronesses, but don't hold that against them. But Kate and Arlene, how must they feel when he's giving an interview to the Irish Times and he said, "Oh, yes, and a united Ireland's inevitable, just like an Islamic Great Britain is apparently inevitable." He's not going to do it for you. He's not going to do it for you. He was culturally conservative in a way that suited that particular issue. Michael Cavino says, "Hi, Mark. Did you see the news last week that the Broccoli family sold over their rights to the 007 franchise to Amazon, the owner of MGM Studios? How soon before Amazon destroys the Bond franchise as Disney did with Star Wars? I'm kind of surprised the Broccoli family sold out, but I guess the big bucks from Bezos was just too much. Let's just say I'm shaken and stirred from this development. Hope you are feeling better." Barbara Broccoli and her whatever he is, half-brother. The Broccoli family has basically controlled Bond since he started on screen. And they've adapted to changing times. So people can complain about, you know, the transition from Sean Connery to Roger Moore and then to that rather dour Welsh fellow, and then to the Irish Chancer, and then to Daniel Craig. But they've done a pretty good job at riding shifting public tastes. And I don't believe whoever's in charge of Bond at Amazon will know the first thing about that. I mean, Bond is a very particular thing. I noticed that when they paid tribute to 50 years of Bond or whatever it was, was this the time of Skyfall? They put together a montage from the Bond films, and the montage from the Bond films was just car crashes and explosions and shooting. And that's not, that's not really what Bond is about. Bond is different from Jason Bourne, because Bond's the guy who tosses the space heater in the bathtub and electrocutes the guy and then says, "Shocking." He's the one when M says, "Moneypenny, where's Bond? He's on a mission in Austria." "Well, tell him to pull out immediately." And then the camera cuts to Bond, shagging his way across Europe. That's what it's... The explosions and the car chases aren't what it's about at all. "I'm afraid you're going rather tiresome, Mr. Bond." "Do you expect me to talk?" "No, I expect you to die." They didn't even get... When they did him at the Oscars, they didn't even get what he's about. Now, I think they wrecked him, these guys, Barbara Broccoli and... the last few films, the one, the No Time to Die. So they turned Bond into this big mopey guy who's just like moping around all over the place. And it's not about anything. You know, even Roger Moore, they were about the Cold War. You know, the wrinkle would be that occasionally Bond, after he'd shagged the Soviet bird, would have to cooperate with the Soviet bird to defeat Blofeld or whoever. Now, but they were at least rooted in a kind of reality. Now, nothing is about anything. Oh, yeah, Le Chiffre turned out to be working for Quantum, and Quantum turned out to be working for Spectre, and Spectre turned out to be working for Blofeld, who's basically Bond's stepbrother from decades ago when they were kids, and so he's just working out a few fraternal issues together. So it wasn't about anything. And the other thing they got wrong, I had a conversation with this about David Arnold. You've heard David on some of our shows. David Arnold succeeded John Barry as Bond's composer, and so he did, and then into the in the 90s and then into the 2000s. So he did Die Another Day, and he did what was the first Daniel Craig film? Oh, Casino Royale. And he did whatever the next one was called. And he said, he and I were just chatting about this, and he thought that that by digging deep, they'd actually misread a lot of the central appeal of Bond, which is that he floats on the surface. He's a bit like, if you think about it, he's a bit like Ian Fleming's neighbor in Jamaica, Noel Coward. A Noel Coward play, all the depth is on the surface. And that's Bond when he's just sort of gliding through, but James, I need you. So does England. And then he goes skiing off down the cliff and gets all, with all the Soviet guys chasing after him. Now, so when you try to make a deep Bond, you can only go so far with that. And by the end, Daniel Craig, I thought the No Time to Die was the most bloody awful bore. But maybe I'm just wrong. Maybe Daniel Craig is the Nigel Farage of James Bond's. But I don't suppose they'll be doing a great job with that. That was an interesting question. I'm sorry to go. I went on a bit too long about it. The not so gay Hussar writes. I like gay Hussar. The not-so-gay Hussar says, hi, new member here. Not interested in Trump, tariffs, or who's 2 points ahead in Iowa. Looking to find out why the lyrics to Follow Me on the Sinatra Ellington album were rewritten and who did them. They're even more senseless and obscure than the original in Camelot. Can't imagine that Lerner wrote those droopy hippie lyrics. Can you enlighten me? I honestly don't know. It wasn't Alan J. Lerner, because I once asked Alan about that, sitting in his delightful house in Chelsea in London. Because we were talking about Frank Sinatra. They knew each other a little. Sometimes when he wanted rewritten lyrics, he did go to the original lyricist. Ira Gershwin wrote the lyrics for his version of The Gal That Got Away. The Man That Got Away, that he did as The Gal That Got Away. And Leo Robin, the original lyricist of Thanks for the Memory, wrote new lyrics for Frank. And Hugh Martin, the original lyricist of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, wrote new lyrics for Frank. He'd just call them up and ask if they'd do it. And they, and as far as I know, the only one who ever said no to him was Alan Bergman over, The Summer Knows. And then there were other occasions, like with Paul Simon. I've talked about this because It's now Paul Simon's favourite cover version of any of his songs. He plays it. If he comes off stage and the show's gone well, he plays Sinatra singing Mrs. Robinson with its rewritten lyrics by, because Frank didn't get the song at all, so he just got Sammy Khan to rewrite him some new lyrics. But I don't know with that one. That's an intriguing question. I know it wasn't Alan. I'll see if I can find out who it actually was. Alison Castellina says, today Nigel Farage has said there is no way back for Rupert Lowe into the Reform Party on account of his robustness over Rotherham. Has Nigel completely lost his political instincts? No. Nigel is always about Nigel, which is why many parties he's founded ever goes beyond the Nigel party. He just can't handle it. You know, the one thing I'd say, I've learned certain things over the years. Being a guest host taught me a lot. Rush, for example. The Rush Limbaugh show, I was delighted to be a guest host there. And as you know, I stuck with Rush till the very last day. It cost me $1 million for a while in the DC Superior Court when they heard that I was a Rush Limbaugh guest host. Now, of course, Michael E. Mann is having to write checks to the Rush Limbaugh guest host. But Rush was completely secure. Now, there's another big guy on the American right who's completely insecure. So he doesn't like it. He doesn't... The whole game... Did Tucker and I, actually, because Tucker's the same. Tucker and I used to joke about that. Hillary and Bill and Hillary, they did some event, I think it was at Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto, and they only sold 16% of the seats. And Tucker asked me about this on air, and I said, yeah, it's like when I guest host for you, there's only 16% of the audience. And we both laughed. That actually, as Tucker pointed out, that actually isn't true, but Tucker's completely secure about things like that. Rush was completely secure about things like that. Other persons are not. They're not so secure in themselves. And Trump is completely secure about that. When Trump does his thing, like he used to do this thing, it always, Greg Gutfeld always found it, when he'd go, whoever it was on Fox, he'd go, Sean, he's very strong, and Judge Jeanine, she's very strong. Greg, I like Greg, but he's not so strong. He used to do, he couldn't care less. That's why he's got all these extraordinary, the big difference between now and the first term, the 45th president, when he was just surrounded by these, you know, Republican establishment types. Now he's got people who are their own men, whether they're men or women. But Tulsi is her own man. When she pointed out the reality of what was the confirmation hearing, when she pointed out the reality of what's going on in Syria and all that sort of uniparty bomb the world crowd were going, oh, well, this shows she's completely unqualified for the job. No, she was right a month in advance. And he's completely relaxed about that. It's just like Rush didn't think some niche Canadian is any threat to him. In the same way that Trump doesn't think, you know, Tulsi or RFK Jr. or Elon Musk is a threat to him. He's completely secure in that sense. And in that sense, he's the complete opposite of Nigel Farage, which is the problem. Kiwi Gav in London, I take it that is a person from New Zealand, possibly called Gavin. Does he live in Earl's Court, or is that just Australians, Kiwi Gav? Goes, Mark, I don't know. I'm so out of touch with the London. Earls Court's probably full of Somalis now, isn't it? Anyway, Kiwi Gav says, Mark, I hope you're well. You've certainly sounded in better health and higher spirits in the last few weeks. The Farage versus Lowe spat sounds messy, but maybe a necessary mess. You've rightly been critical of Nigel's over-gatekeeping, but he does get voters out. Well, steady on. He had 6 MPs now down? No, I think he had 5 MPs, but it's now down to 4, right? So he doesn't get that many voters out. Does Rupert Lowe really have the pulling power to bring change to UK politics, or is the flimsy pack of reform cards about to fall? And then what are we left with? Well, look, Father Calvin Robinson, who will be on the Mark Steyn cruise next month, Dan Wootton, who will also be on the Mark Steyn cruise next month, Dan and Calvin were talking about it. Dan is an optimistic guy. He's your fellow Kiwi, Gav. He's an optimistic guy, and Father Calvin is less so. So Father Calvin concluded that he thought it was too late. That so much, and I've just been completely revolted. The everything now, every shop you go into, every event you attend, they're now doing this big Ramadan thing. So they pause the footy. You know, I used to like, you know, the footy. I can't even remember that the last time I went to a football match. But the idea of pausing it, they'd only pause it so all the Millwall fans could take a leak in the stands on the guy in the row in front. That's the only reason they ever used to pause it. Now they have... Now they pause it for some Ramadan prostrations. I think we linked to it. I think we put the video clip in there. Then you see the king having Ramadan observances in St. George's Chapel, which the late queen would never have done. So Father Calvin says, we've left it too late. We've left it too late. And the guy who's going to save you from an Islamic future... He's not going to be a guy who says, oh, no, we don't want to talk about grooming gangs and all that. We don't want to talk in any meaningful way about grooming gangs. In every city of any size, Pakistani Muslims gang rape English girls. They anally brand English girls, right? But because that's a bit too much for Nigel... he doesn't want to talk about it. He certainly doesn't want to talk about it in a way that would make a difference. Rupert Lowe had said he's prepared to bankroll a national inquiry into it with his own money. Because Starmer and the Ginger Growler won't agree to investigate it. The reality is, I linked to that thing that this guy, Professor Betts, he's Canadian. He's very respectable. He advises governments. He advises governments all around the Commonwealth. And he has concluded that within 5 years, we will be in some kind of Latin American style dirty war. Now, if you just imagine, because people, not Nigel Farage, he'll still be doing his hail fellow well met shtick with Zia Yusuf. But if you go back to what the Home Office calculated at the height of the Irish Troubles, that there were no more than 100 active IRA guys, you know, so 100 guys going around, skulking about, blowing the legs off grannies at bus stops and all the rest of it. And those 100 people were nevertheless able to tie down a huge percentage of British policy, British domestic policy in the 70s, 80s, 90s, just because they had a fairly comfortable pool to swim in. Now, of half a million, say, you know, I'm not saying if you're an Ulster Catholic listening to this, I'm not saying that you support the IRA, certainly not at all, because there's an awful lot of Ulster Catholics who reviled them. But there was a big enough comfort zone from that half a million for them to send a mortar through the windows of Downing Street to kill members of the royal family. Now, you talk about what's the pool you can swim in for 50 million people or whatever it is in England. And so this guy, very soberly, talking to Louise Perry about how there's going to be certain priorities. You're going to have to, you know, secure the fantastic artistic heritage of the United Kingdom, because these people will think of nothing. In the end, there's going to be people on the other side who are going to want to destroy great English works of art or whatever. Going to want to destroy the hay wain by Constable or whatever. You're going to have to secure all your military facilities and your power grids and all the rest of it. Because otherwise, if people can just take out the power grid and all the rest of it, or they can seize an army base or whatever. We're not even talking about, you know, the way they talk about Pakistan, where if supposedly the Americans have plans for if the powder keg goes up there, then they all fly in and secure all the nukes. Yeah, well, I'll see how that goes. But he's basically says that the low-grade civil war can't be prevented. And so you have to, he's just thinking about mitigation measures, like ensuring that fabulous paintings don't get destroyed and the electric grid doesn't get taken out. And that's the stage we're at. So when Captain Pansy Pants says, oh, no, these are not things I'm interested in talking about, you know, I won't. Well, maybe I will if I'm in a bad mood. I'm in a bad mood about the girls of Rotherham and the other towns because of what he said. It's a moral question, you hollow little man. It's a moral question. You can't just let your girls be raped because you don't fancy them yourself. I remember the last time I was on a stage with Nigel, you know, this isn't going to do it for you. By the time of if Starmer can serve a full term by 2029, We will be basically picking sides for societal disintegration. That's how late all the respectable buggers. And the cultural conservative thing, the pub bore thing, the 60 fags a day thing, that was right for Brexit. It's not right for. He's not prepared to. It conceivably might work for the Islamization, because there's not going to be pubs. There'll be no pub bores in a semi-Islamic England. Oh well. Anyway, I shouldn't. I'm shocked, by the way, by the things that have emerged in recent days about all the people who are really. Who are the sort of people you need in a wide spectrum party, like Ben Habib, like Rupert Lowe, I can't stand the Rees-Mogg's myself, but Rees-Mogg's sister didn't deserve to have done to her what Nigel did to her. He's a contemptible man, and for me, the girls of Rotherham, he says, those girls, I was disgusted. The first I heard about that, I was disgusted. And I'm even more disgusted now, after 10, 12 years, whatever the hell it is. And people still, she was dangled off a balcony by a group of these. Yeah. I said all that back in 2014 or whatever. It's time to do something for these girls. Why can't you do that, Nigel? Why can't you do that? Is that too much to ask? I don't know. I'm getting angry now. And that's never a good thing. This has been... I hate it when I get angry, but I do get angry because that's a very... If you listen to Louise Perry's interview with Professor Betts, King's College London, that's as sobering as anything you are going to hear. And it's certainly worth your time more than Nigel doing his rumpy pumpy shtick from 20 years ago. This has been Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A. That's going to do it for today. Do stick with Steyn Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen is going to round up the internet as only she can. And on Friday, we'll be starting a brand new Tale for Our Time. I hope you'll want to swing by and join me for that. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, come on in. The water's fine. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.